From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Cheryl Corley. Both Sarah Palin and Joe Biden were back on the campaign trail today after their debate last night. The two candidates got a chance to meet each other face-to-face for the first time and tried to convince voters their ticket was the best choice for America.
So you're going to have to replace a $12,000 plan with a $5,000 check you've just given to the insurance company. I call that the ultimate bridge to nowhere.
I say it ain't so, Joe. There you'll go again, pointing backwards again, though. You prefaced your whole comment with the Bush administration.
Of course, the candidates for vice president. Joining us from St. Louis to talk about the debate is NPR's own Farai Chidea. Hi, Farai.
Hey, Cheryl.
Well, there was so much expectation about this debate. How do you think these candidates fared?
It was all in the eye of the beholder. If you go online and look at different websites, ones that are more partisan will say, oh, well, yeah, Obama supporters say, yes, Biden won decisively. Palin supporters will say Palin held her own. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people said, I mean, frankly, one of our own blogging contributors, Michael Cobb Bowen, said, prepare for implosion. He's someone who had come on our show and said that he was a McCain voter, but he was really annoyed, to say the least, with Sarah Palin. I don't think there was that implosion last night. I don't think that she acquitted herself so badly that people who support their ticket are wringing their hands, but it wasn't a decision changer for, I think, many voters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about their demeanor just a little bit. I mean, Governor Palin was folksy, giving a shout-out even to her brother's third grade class, and Senator Biden was talking about his connections to regular folks. What do you think they were trying to get across with those comments?
First of all, Jack and Jill Politics, another one of our blogging contributors, said you cannot give a shout out in a vice presidential debate. So that's going to be an etiquette point from now on, is whether or not you can give shout outs. But there was a lot of effort to seem middle class. You have to remember that simply by being in, you know, national politics, whether you're a governor or a senator, your family's going to be making a lot more than the average American family. But everyone's clinging desperately to the idea of being a politician who's so middle class. And so the battle was really over, not just the facial demeanor, but the class demeanor. You know, I'm from Scranton. I'm from Wasilla. These are the values we have. These are your values. And so there was a lot of that positioning that went on last night.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we are in this middle of an economic crisis. Let's hear what Sarah Palin had to say about that.
Let's commit ourselves, just everyday American people, Joe Sixpack, hockey moms across the nation. I think we need to band together and say, never again. Never will we be exploited and taken advantage of again by those who are managing our money and loaning us these dollars.
So did Sarah Palin kind of assure voters that she had a firm grasp on what's happening with the economy?
Again, I think it was an eye of the beholder. A lot of people said before this debate that the bar was set fairly low because of recent interviews that the governor gave that were not so flattering to her grasp of policy or her ability to communicate it. The bar was pretty low. And, you know, although she tended to answer what questions she wanted to when she wanted to and said so much to the moderator, Gwen Ifill, she was like, I'm going to answer basically what I want to answer. But she did make a point that I think was very distinct between the tax policy that she and Senator McCain favor, which is much like the existing Bush tax policy, versus the Biden-Obama tax policy, which would restructure who gets tax breaks and put it more to the middle class. And that's a very clear distinction for voters. They have to decide what they want. And I do think in that case, her comments were helpful in helping people decide.
We have one last clip we want to get in here real quickly, Farai. Joe Biden attacking John McCain's reputation as a maverick. Let's listen to that.
He's not been a maverick when it comes to education. He has not supported tax cuts and significant changes for people being able to send their kids to college. He's not been a maverick on the war. He's not been a maverick on virtually anything that generally affects the things that people really talk about around their kitchen table.
So how do you think that came across to voters?
I think that people who were listening for debate hot points loved that. It's a classic, you know, you're no Joe Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, kind of a line. And So that, I think, also speaks to a clear distinction on, you know, the two tickets, one of whom, the Democratic ticket, wants to have a 16-month timeline for pulling out of Iraq, and another one that doesn't. So I think voters who were listening on the issues actually got some very good information.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you'll be talking much more about these candidates and the presidential candidates as well as their upcoming debates happen. So NPR's Farai Chidea, thank you so much for joining us from St. Louis.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Two quick polls are giving Senator Joe Biden the edge over Governor Sarah Palin in last night's vice presidential debate. How will last night's face-off affect the election in November? And the U.S. economy lost about 159,000 jobs last month, according to the Labor Department. What do those numbers mean for our sputtering economy? We turn to our reporters' roundtable for answers. And with us today is Theola LeBay-DeBose, a staff writer for The Washington Post, and Greer Holmes, a public affairs reporter at WRVS-FM in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Hi.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us on News and Notes. Well, let's talk about the big news of last night, the vice presidential candidates finally squaring off in St. Louis, both contenders. Of course, we had Senator Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. We heard from Farai. How do you guys, or ladies, rank the candidates' performances? Why don't we begin with you, Theola?
Well, I thought that both of them did very well in terms of avoiding the pitfalls that they could have fallen into going in, Senator Biden being overblown and Sarah Palin just sort of looking dumb, you know, given her performance in some media interviews in the past couple of days. I don't think that it was a big game changer in terms of independents making up their minds. It was almost like a draw in terms of nothing really changed except that we got to see them both perform.
Mm. Greer, you agree?
I agree 100%. It just seemed like everyone was having a very carefully orchestrated, you know, conversation where we're not going to step on each other's toes, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, both candidates really tried to appeal to the middle-class voter, with Governor Palin saying that John McCain had picked her for more than her executive experience.
Oh, I think that was pretty obvious.
I think we have a little clip that we're going to play about that. So let's hear the governor.
Being a mom, being one who is very concerned about a son in the war, about a special needs child, about kids heading off to college, how are we going to pay those tuition bills, about times in Todd and in our marriage in our past where we didn't have health insurance, and we know what other Americans are going through as they sit around the kitchen table and try to figure out how are they going to pay out of pocket for health care. We've been there also, so that connection was important.
And I also want to have you listen to what Joe Biden had to say, too. He also referred to his middle-class roots during the debate.
Look, the people in my neighborhood, they get it. They get it. And they know they've been getting the short end of the stick. So walk with me in my neighborhood. Go back to my old neighborhood in Claymont, an old steel town, or go up to Scranton with me. These people know the middle class has gotten the short end. The wealthy have done very well. Corporate America has been rewarded. It's of time. We change it. Barack Obama will change it.
Now, both of these candidates are really stressing this point and really appealing to middle-class voters during the debate and throughout the election. Why do you think this type of appeal is so important during this election? Greer, let me start with you.
I think that because at some point during this process, they kind of lost the middle class. And then that became a pivoting point because then they tried to show that one party versus another wasn't addressing those real issues, and because corporate America's issues kept coming forward. And I believe that now they realize that the people who really need to be cared for are the ones who are going to be coming out voting en masse, because some of the issues as far as bailouts, when they have issues, no one's bailing them out. When they were hearing about foreclosures, there was no real conversation about making sure that they themselves weren't going to lose. And so now it appears that they're realizing that, you know, America as a whole needs to know how their needs are going to be addressed you know, from a different level, because we've addressed everyone else's. What about ours?
I agree completely. I mean, at this point, anybody who appears to have a bit of money is a target. Look at the economy. Look at the price of groceries. Every American right now is just clutching their pocketbook a little bit closer. And even though folks like Sarah Palin and Senator Biden, even Barack Obama, that's why the whole comments from John McCain about, I don't know how many homes I own, it really has to come back to ordinary people paying their bills at the end of the month. Do they have enough money for that? And if they don't, they would like the person or people who they elect to basically help them with that.
One last question about this vice presidential race. We had a new poll come out. 51% of those polled said Biden did the best job, 36% for Palin. On the other hand, the respondent said that Palin was much more likable. Think those those perceptions are going to have much effect? Only have a few seconds here. In fact, Greer, why don't I ask you that? You think that's going to make much impact on this election?
I really don't, especially since we're going through this whole economic, how we're going to resolve our issues. We like you, but can you do anything for us?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really going to be the big issue, especially because of how, you know, things have been handled. You know, we can love you, but are you really going to address our issues? I believe that's America's bottom line.
Well, I'm going to ask both of you to stick around for a few minutes while we take a break. We'll be back to continue this conversation. This is News and Notes. I'm Cheryl Corley. We're back with our Reporters Roundtable with Greer Holmes, a public affairs reporter at WRVS-FM in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and Thiela LeBay-DeBose, a staff writer for The Washington Post. So let's jump right back into this. Ladies, yesterday the McCain camp announced it was pulling out of Michigan. The state has voted for the Democrat in the last four elections, but it was considered a swing state this time around. So what do you think this move shows about McCain's campaign's viability? Thiela, why don't we begin with you?
To me, it just looks like they're nervous, but that they're actually admitting that. At the same time, we've also seen McCain take some very public moves over the past few weeks, suspending campaigning to come back to Washington, first not criticizing Gwen Ifill and her objectivity, and then suddenly, you know, coming back and saying, oh, she's biased, and now this. So on some level, this is the latest series of sort of strange decisions, and not quite sure what to make of it, except it would appear that basically, you know, they're saying, okay, we need to concentrate on places where we could actually lose, but then this one, we know we will lose, so there.
Well, of course, the big issue with Michigan is it's struggling with the nation's highest unemployment rate. The economy is the top issue in this campaign. Greer, why hasn't McCain been able to connect with voters and gain ground on this issue, or do you think he has?
I don't think he has. That's just my opinion, because he has made some of the strange moves. He's also has basically let everyone know that, you know, his price point is very different. When he's talking about middle class being 5 million and under, and then you have to go to a state where people are saying, we just want to be employed, I don't think he feels that he can connect on that level. Even with, you know, the perception that he's willing to go out and bail out large corporations, but I think in a way pulling out of Michigan is almost saying, I guess, you know, we are not going to win because we don't have your agenda in mind.
Well, speaking of bailout, the House of Representatives has been started earlier today in kind of its round two to pass that massive financial bailout bill that it defeated earlier this week. And at the time of us speaking, the lawmakers hadn't really voted on the measure. What do you think changed the bill to gain support in the House, though? Thiela, what's happened there?
I think that it's clear that the price of inaction was not going to win anyone political votes, either in Washington or back home. The interesting thing about this bailout, Cheryl, is that the second time Bush got back on television, not the first time, but then the second time after the bill was initially voted down. President Bush started to call this a loan and not a bailout. And it just made me wonder, had this been called a loan the entire time, and if the American people had the sense that their tax dollars would be paid back, would this have gone differently?
So you're saying it's about semantics?
I'm saying it's about Americans, just like Greer said earlier, really wanting to know, what are you going to do for me and my issues? You know, you tell me that these big companies lost money and that they took my mortgage and then chopped it up and sold it. Okay, that's fine. However, should we just, on the first try, really basically give this, you know, hard-earned taxpayer money away? I think that in some sense, the action had to fail initially just so that that could engender conversation about these hard questions, which would then give the legislature the political capital to now say, okay, I will support it, because if this goes on any longer, people will get hurt.
Mm-hmm. So let's say the bill passes, which it's looking like might actually happen. Mm-hmm. How does it really help the economy?
That actually remains to be seen. No one really knows. I mean, obviously, a lot of this, you know, the stock market going up and down, it's about confidence, it's about emotion. The funny thing is, we're talking about dollars and cents, but at the same time, when you have the largest one-day sell-off in history, it's just really about people's confidence. And so in some sense, if the bill is done, taken care of, Bush sort of gets this done as one of the last big things under his tenure, then I think that Americans will be looking to the next president to basically be the steward of this process and then to make sure that it gets implemented correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to take you to a story about figures and numbers, a different one, but a related one. The Labor Department numbers released today show that September saw the biggest drop in joblessness in 5 years. The economy lost 159,000 jobs last month. Unemployment is now at 6.1%. So how's that going to affect the confidence in our economy?
There is no confidence right now. I would say that. No. I think that, you know, to me, the funniest line last night from the debate was Sarah Palin talking about go to a soccer game and then you'll hear people talking about the economy. Now, I'm sure that
she said that they would be afraid.
Yeah. I'm sure. I think that there's not soccer in Alaska, but I can tell you in D.C. that is what people are talking about,
and around the water cooler, around all over America.
Absolutely.
So we saw the service sector, construction, manufacturing sector, all saw big drops last month. What kind of ripple effects will these kinds of losses have on the economy?
I think they're going to be very impactful. Just the idea that small businesses are going to be unable to keep their money afloat because of their process of having to get loans and being able to pay employees. And then you also have so many things are dependent on everything else, transportation. There's so many real critical areas where if one falls, it's like a house of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And with the economy, at some point, we have to – I think America is really looking for just some really hope at the end of this, a very long, very dark tunnel. And when you're talking about helping, like, the families and trying to get industry going back, right now it's going to be kind of hard because we don't even see where there's, you know, if we keep dropping off, you know, when is it going to start coming up? We don't even have a clue as when the upsurge is going to be coming.
Well, I want to keep the issue on jobs and the economy because earlier this week, President Bush signed a spending bill that included a lifeline to struggling U.S. automakers, $25 billion, that will allow the automakers to get government-guaranteed loans to kind of retool their factories to make fuel-efficient cars. We only have a few seconds left. But how has this latest credit crunch affected domestic car manufacturers? Are they really just struggling right now, and is this going to help?
They are struggling completely. I mean, obviously, the car is as American as apple pie. Ford, you know, all these guys, Detroit, Motor City. I think that, honestly, the word bailout should be banned. Every single PR person should just sort of brand it differently here. But I think that it is no surprise to anyone that the big three are in trouble. I mean, basically, any large titans, including the U.S. economy and Wall Street, titans it across all sectors are just very weak right now.
They're falling.
Well, we're going to have to leave it on that less than optimistic note, ladies. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Theola LeBay-Du Bois, a staff writer for The Washington Post, Greer Holmes, a public affairs reporter at WRVS-FM in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And we continue our series on voting today, and we turn our attention to the actual act of having your say at the ballot box.
If you care about gun control,
women's rights, civil rights,
rising gas prices,
Social Security,
the war, then you should vote.
Celebrities there encouraging people to get out and vote in a new online campaign called Declare Yourself. Well, there's really no one way to cast a ballot, and with so many voting methods have come controversies. Controversies about flawed ballots, about accessibility, and whether our votes even count. Well, joining me to dissect the country's voting systems is Benjamin Griffith. He's a member of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Election Law and editor of the book, America Votes, A Modern Guide to Election Law and Voting Rights. Welcome to News and Notes.
Cheryl, thank you for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Well, Benjamin, in the first 3 months of this year, there were 3 million newly registered voters. And I'm from Chicago, so that's about the size of that city.
Right.
That was just the beginning. So there may be a number of people voting for the first time during this election, a number of people who may not have voted for a while. What can people expect once they arrive at a polling place?
Well, we've made tremendous strides since 2000 when we had the butterfly ballot problems in Florida that spilled over to Bush v. Gore. We've seen major federal funding, over $300 billion pumped into new voting machines, electronic technology, different types of machines and technology to replace the old lever machines and certainly the old paper ballot system. We're not perfect. I think what we've got is an election system that is essentially relegated to the state and local level. There's a good deal of federal guidance and federal design, but mostly we're dealing with a local election system. That's always been our problem for in terms of lack of uniformity, and we'll continue to experience that in 2008.
So why do all these different systems exist then?
Well, it's I guess in a word, it's federalism. We're a nation that is not necessarily governed exclusively by the federal government. There are federal protections that are obviously related to voting and protection of voting rights, but states and local governments generally, from the beginning of our nation, have had the primary responsibility to carry out the process of voting and to guard the voting rights of individuals and to make sure the electoral process made sense. When we have a breakdown like we did in Florida, and it's under the international spotlight, as this one was, it's not just embarrassing. It is an absolute travesty. And when we had our federal, state, and local officials and experts pool their knowledge, we came up with a number of federal solutions, and that has trickled down to training and education programs on the local level. We can address those later.
But you say lots of money has been spent on the new voting machines, voter registration databases. So why are we still seeing problems? Don't we test these machines and the systems for usability, make sure people can get through this process easily?
Well, let me give you a little nightmare. The Brennan Center for Justice just a few months ago published a report that pointed out some major design flaws in ballot layout, the text formatting, and voting instructions. In short, people, particularly elderly people, minorities, people who were voting for the first time were confused. They were not able to understand what they were voting for. Two or three common examples. Candidates were being listed for the same office on two or more pages or columns. Multiple elections on the same screen on an electronic touchscreen system. Response options on both sides of a candidate name. Instructions that were full of legal jargon. That's difficult for many lawyers to understand, let alone laypersons. What the Brennan Center came up with were very, very good suggestions, and I think these recommendations can be carried to the state and local level as well as the federal level. Let me summarize them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
We need a checklist of best practices, design best practices for ballot designers and voting systems. We need usability testing of ballots mm-hmm. before you come down to the final design and instructions. Make sure, use test groups, focus groups. Publicize sample ballots that look like the real thing. Make the necessary changes that will be based on testing and public samples, and require counties. The counties and precincts are generally where the rubber meets the road. This is where the election process takes place for most of us. We need reporting on overvotes, undervotes, spoiled ballots, and finally, review and amend the election laws where they prevent local governments from employing the most usable ballot designs.
So you're talking about a lot of help for the election process.
Money.
And money, yes. But not too long ago, 2002, the Help America Vote Act was passed. So what did that act do, and what kind of impact has it had?
Well, HAVA did a lot of things and a lot of good things, and I don't want this to sound negative overall because it was positive. We have a lot of positive changes that you're going to see in this election that flow out of HAVA.
Mm-hmm.
The Help America Vote Act wasn't just simply replacing butterfly ballots with electronic voting. It has led to a resurgence and an increased use of Election Day registration. You register to vote the day you go to vote. It's done in Europe. It's done in other countries throughout the world. Early voting, not just early voting in case you're on a business trip or have a business conflict, but early voting if you want to vote and get it out of the way. The statewide voter registry systems, uniform assistance coming from a federal agency now called the Election Assistance Administration, and then disability access. That continues to be a problem, but what we're talking about is something that will reach out and help the marginalized, help them to exercise their right to vote without impediment.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering how this process, we have a lot of folks overseas these days, and so how does this process differ for Americans who are overseas or in the armed forces?
Well, you'll recall as a lot of the nail-biting took place in 2000 and 2004
yeah.
about late ballots coming in from overseas. That process has been ramped up, streamlined, designed with a more narrowly tailored and a more accurate methodology. I think it's going to work better. I think we've got more communication top-down, and that's the big issue. Is there knowledge and an awareness of deadlines? What can be done to promote awareness among our armed forces? These men and women are in harm's way. They're basically standing in the door and guarding us while we're back home. We need to do everything possible to open the doors to electoral access as widely as possible for them. That's being done. It's not perfect, but you're going to see major improvements compared to the last two electoral cycles.
Yeah, well, let me ask you real quickly. Let's say somebody's registered. They arrive at the polling station. They have their ID. Their paperwork's in order. A poll worker says they can't vote.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, if you run into voter intimidation or a person basically being told you're in the wrong place, go somewhere else, which, you know, when you're paying $4.50 a gallon for gas, that's a big issue sometimes. It's an issue for a lot of us. There have to be methods, and there have to be ways to actually step in and provide voter protection. Two things are going on right now. The American Bar Association has a tremendous information-filled website with the ABA, and it deals with the American Bar Association President Tommy Wells' theme that I think he's underlying. He wants to encourage all citizens to exercise their right to vote. And he's given a call to action for lawyers everywhere to get involved in the election.
All right. Well, I'll have to stop you right there, sir. We'll have folks check out that website. That
was great.
Thank you. Benjamin Griffith, a member of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Election Law. I'm Cheryl Corley, and this is News in Notes. Listen to this. The Electoral College. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? Well, you may not sit at home discussing the inner workings of the Electoral College. Well, I won't presume, but more than likely not. But it is key in deciding who gets into the White House. But does anyone really understand how it works? Here's what some people in Los Angeles had to say about it.
What I know about the Electoral College, I know from civics. So there's not really too much clarity as far as going on with that. So I don't know. Where there's no clarity, there's room for secrecy.
A college for like people to just go and learn and hang out and happen?
I've never heard of it.
Well, it means each state has electoral votes. What I would like is we would do away with electoral votes and that every man's vote is counted.
Well, here to help us demystify the Electoral College is Ange Marie Hancock. She's an assistant professor in political science at the University of Southern California and knows a thing or two about the Electoral College. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so this is Voting 101, and I suppose we should begin by saying the Electoral College is really not a place. Is that right?
Exactly, exactly. It's a collection of people,
yeah,
and not an actual location of bricks and mortar buildings.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought you might have been a little alarmed by what people were saying on the street there.
I'd almost rather people didn't know rather than think it's a bricks and mortar location they can go to or protest.
Okay. So what's the history behind the college itself?
Well, the college has basically been around since the United States has been around. Mm-hmm. It is enshrined in our Constitution, which is why even though there have been periodic calls for its eradication, it's a very difficult process to get rid of it. It would take a constitutional amendment.
Ah.
And as we know, we've only done that 20 to 30 times in our entire history. So
yeah,
it is a very difficult process to get rid of. Essentially, however, there is a 538 electors that are basically redistributed every 10 years based on the census, the same way that the House of Representatives is redistributed in terms of numbers that each state gets. Every state, just like every state gets two senators, every state gets two electors. And then on top of that, based on population shifts, they will get a certain additional number of electors assigned to their states.
Does it correspond with the number of representatives? So what you said, two are for senators. And
right.
Then
so
the
100
rest
of the electors are allocated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then 435 are apportioned every 10 years based on the population shifts among the states. And then there are three electors that are given to the District of Columbia so that the District of Columbia can actually participate in the presidential election.
So talk a little bit about how these electors are chosen then.
The electors are actually chosen by the political parties. So based on the ways in which the voting takes place on Election Day, a slate of electors will then be put forth based on which candidate and which party actually won the presidential vote.
Mm-hmm.
Most times it's a winner-take-all situation. Only two states allocate by a congressional district or by proportional representation. So if Barack Obama or John McCain wins the state of California, for example, whichever candidate wins gets the entire slate of electors that their party has nominated to vote in the Electoral College.
Well, so talk a little bit more about that, because the Electoral College tends to kind of mirror the popular public vote in each state, if I'm correct. But are electors really required to do that?
There's no formal requirement that can happen. And so that's actually one of the arguments against the Electoral College, is that in certain situations it is possible in theory, although it hasn't happened in any time in recent history, that an elector could be bribed or an elector could be somehow swayed to vote against the actual slate that they were elected to represent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there was some debate about that, for example, in 2000, as to whether or not there might be some switching based on this idea that there were people who genuinely believed that Al Gore won. And if they were Republicans, they might actually do the right thing, if you will, or at least that was the hope among people who were supporters of Gore.
Explain how when these electors actually, I guess, either do their voting.
The electors actually are called to vote, obviously, after November 4th,
right.
After every election day.
Uh-huh.
They actually get together in their states and then cast the votes. And so the votes are reported from the states. There was a time when they were getting together in a centralized location, but they're no longer required to do so.
Mm-hmm. And that's when, during that time period, is when the actual influence could occur if anything like that actually happens.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So you said that this has been with us from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So George Washington, John Adams, were they elected by the electoral colleges?
Actually, there was an electoral college after about four elections or so. And the electoral college has been around, but the shifts and the changes that took place, they had about four elections with an electoral college in one framework. And then they decided to make some adjustments as the emergence of political parties came around. And so what they did in the 12th Amendment, for example, was to actually go through and decide that they were going to have the article, Article 2 of the Constitution, said that they would be allocated by state. And then the 12th Amendment made a few changes, one of which was to stop them from actually going through and having to gather together in a centralized location.
Mm-hmm. Well, we heard from one man at the beginning of our little montage of people who said he liked to see a one man, one vote system instead of this kind of indirect electoral college system. So what are the pitfalls of electing a president by popular vote?
Well, there are a couple of different pitfalls, and depending on, I guess, where you live, you might actually have different views on the particular political – on the particular perspective of whether we should have an electoral college. For example, the electoral college right now gives an undue weight to smaller states. So, for example, the state of Wyoming, if you cast a vote in the state of Wyoming based on the ways in which the electors are allocated, their vote actually counts – four times the weight of someone voting in California, a much more populous state.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do truly believe in one man, one vote, then, of course, what you would have is to take care of that weighting problem so that the voters of Wyoming would have the same as California. On the other hand, what you might have is political parties and candidates running national campaigns and totally overlooking and bypassing some of those smaller states so that you would have an Obama or McCain not even bothering to ever stop in Wyoming, certainly not ever bothering to stop in some of the smaller states and concentrating all of their attention on the larger states.
Well, I'm sure that this will be a question that goes on and on and on throughout time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Anj Marie Hancock. She's an assistant professor in political science at the University of Southern California and joined me here in our NPR West studios. A new broadband network technology will soon launch in Baltimore. Will it close the digital divide? The Obama camp turns to the iPhone for a new get-out-the-vote strategy, and Google unveils a phone of its own to compete with the Apple handset. Well, here to keep us up to speed with the latest in technology news is our regular contributor, Mario Armstrong. Hi, Mario.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm quite well. Hope you are, too.
Yes, doing good.
Okay. So imagine a city. An entire city blanketed with this ultra-high-speed internet connection. That's no longer a fantasy. In Baltimore, the city is beefing up its internet connectivity next week with a new technology called WiMAX. And Mario, as I understand, people have been calling this Wi-Fi on steroids.
That's a good way of putting it.
So you tested it out. How different is this?
I have tested it out, and it is quite different. I think a lot of people are using that comparison of Wi-Fi on steroids because it is, first and foremost, it is a wireless communications. It is the ability for us to be able to connect our laptops, mobile devices, and other things to the internet wirelessly. The main difference is Wi-Fi hotspots are typically limited in the amount of coverage area, usually up to several hundred feet, around 300 feet or so. So that's why it's useful in places like airports or coffee shops. But you really can't move. You have to stay kind of fixed in that one location. WiMAX, on the other hand, one base station can really give you about 30 miles of range. So you have 300 feet from Wi-Fi compared to about 30 miles from WiMAX.
Wow.
And it claims to have faster speeds than Wi-Fi, which I can say at this point in my testing has proven to be true.
Mm-hmm. So why is Sprint launching it in Baltimore?
You know, that's kind of the weird question that we're getting in B-more town, as we call it. You know, people in the West Coast are like,
jealous.
Why not the Valley?
Well, you know? I know it's coming to Chicago, but, you know,
right?
Why do we have
DC
to wait?
Because you guys aren't as cool as Baltimore.
Well, we'll talk about that later. Go ahead.
No, I really think, you know, I think this is good that this is actually being launched in Baltimore for a number of reasons, because you're asking the question and a lot of other people are. But the bottom line is, when I talk to Sprint, Baltimore offers some unique urban characteristics about the city. And ultimately, it's a great test bed. It's not too large. It's not too small. Has a good concentration of people within the city. It has the penetration of people, business professionals, and others that would use this service, and it has all of the interference things that could cause problems and limitations, tall buildings, steel, just all of the trees, just all of the urban environments, things that you would expect in an urban environment. Mm-hmm. So if it can work here, it should work to scale in other places.
Mm-hmm. Want to switch over.
But I still say it's because we're cooler in tech than everybody else.
Of course you would. Well, Senator Obama's campaign took the battle for swing votes to the iPhone this week with a new application called Call Friends. So how does this application work?
Yeah, this is amazing that, you know, his team is like on top of this. So, yeah, Call Friends. Basically, you have an iPhone and you go to the iPhone iPhone store through mm-hmm. iTunes, download the application. And essentially, it's a tool that's kind of designed to help you get more involved, not only with the campaign, but it's directed really at all the people that are in those swing states, which is what I think is very interesting because it helps you organize by contacts in the swing states. And that's what the whole quote unquote Call Friends is about. So it's kind of like 6 degrees of separation that they're trying to reduce to help you call friends that you may know or maybe network to in some of these swing states. So you mm-hmm. can maybe give a little bit more influence or a little bit more impact to the political process.
Well, the Obama campaign, of course, has gotten a lot of attention for its use of technology. And I was wondering if you expect the McCain campaign to roll out anything similar.
You know, I don't know. It would be nice to see that, quite frankly. I think both of these campaigns need to continue to show this type of outreach of utilizing technology. I mean, McCain has launched a new social network as of a few weeks ago called McCain Space, and it is a much better-looking social network than what they had before. So it's a good point that you're raising. They might see this as something that's maybe a waste of time, but, you know, they got this application created in 3 weeks, and normally iPhone developers need way longer than 3 weeks. So that's pretty impressive. So it's feasible that the McCain campaign could turn around and have an application themselves.
Uh-huh. Well, you talk about social networking, so I want to talk just a little bit about that. Facebook, of course, has around 100 million users. MySpace has even more. There's Flickr, there's Twitter, there's all of these things. National Public Radio has gotten into the Web 2.0 world with its launch Woo-hoo. Of an online community. So we're right there with you. New York Times has one as well. So how are all of these social networks, how do they enrich a reader or a listener's experience?
Yeah, well, if they do what they're supposed to do, they're supposed to give voice to the fans, to the members, or to the listeners, or to the people that belong to a membership or an organization or a company. I mean, you have to, it's turning over the control, if you will, of allowing conversations of people that have like-minded interests to be able to make new connections and share their opinions and viewpoints. And at the core, if it does that, then it has the success of having a non-bias, non-agenda type of social platform that really can grow. And I believe, you know, not just being on NPR, not trying to sound overly biased here, that there is a community of loyal listeners mm-hmm. to NPR programming. Mm-hmm. And this could be a platform that allows them to be able to voice their opinions and maybe not always agree with things that happen on NPR, but I think that's always builds a better NPR as well. So I think it's a smart move.
Hmm. Okay, well, I guess we're doing well.
So, I just joined it today. I just signed up, and the sign-up process was easy. I just uploaded my little profile. So people that are listening, you know, hit me up at NPR's social network now. Okay. I'm on there as Digital Dude Mario.
Okay. Well, I want to jump back to the mobile phone news because internet okay. search giant Google has jumped into the phone game. They've unveiled their new smartphone called the G1, and that's supposed to be available in stores later this month. So are we just seeing a big leap here in cell phone capability?
Yeah, it's funny they came out with the G1. It's like, is that a plane or what exactly will this phone, will it fly?
It means that a G2 will be coming your way.
Right. So, yeah, this is an interesting play on Google. They launched with about 34 other member organizations. They created this thing called the Open Handset Alliance. And what that did was started this whole thing of creating a mobile software, and they're calling it Android. So by creating software, they then said, you know, we need mobile devices that could run this software. And that's how we get to T-Mobile and HTC developing this phone called the G1. So it comes out later this month, and it's really being pitched against the iPhone, and it's going to really be interesting to see how this battle between the iPhone, who has done very, very well for itself, versus this newcomer of the G1 on T-Mobile, how they go head to head in the next few weeks.
You think they're going to be able to edge them out?
I think they will. I don't know about edging them out, but I certainly know that the market needs more competition and it needs more ideas. And if Google's behind it and they keep it open source, that would be really good for, I mean, it is open source. That would be really good for application providers and developers to create more things. But, you know, iPhone has already been out for a little while, so they have a jump start. But we need competition because not everybody can get an iPhone because they don't want to be on AT&T.
Yeah.
So I think this is definitely a good option and something that people will definitely get in line for.
Well, Mario, we could go on for days and days. There is so
much. You mean
much...
we're almost done?
We're almost done. There is so much new stuff out there that I just can't, you know.
Another hour for news and notes. We need another hour for news and notes. I'm going to start an MP. There we go. I'll go to the social network and I'll start a community, a new group, another hour for news and notes.
Thank you, Mario. Mario Armstrong is News and Notes regular technology contributor, and he joined us from the studios of the Baltimore Sun.